Well, why don't we go ahead and get started? Looks like we'll be a small group and have a good conversation. Yeah, I was telling Russ, I said, after two sessions yesterday, I think you've heard enough of me. So, but it's glad you're back and wanting to talk about how to future-proof higher education. I do have to start with this quote, though. Trying to predict the future is like trying to drive down a country road at night with no lights while looking out the back window. So there is the reality to the fact that no one can imagine or really knows or understands what the future is going to be. So I don't want to presume that I can get you ready for an exact future. But I do know this. The one thing I can guarantee you about the future is that it will be very different than the one we have today, isn't it? I mean, the pace of change is just mind-boggling in a lot of ways to what we're doing. But what I want to talk to you about today is really two approaches to change that I think I'd like, that we really, really need to consider. And these are the two ways that I believe that we future-proof our organizations. And the first one is really creating an urgency for change. And we'll talk a little bit more in depth about this, but our organizations, in and of themselves, organizations don't tend to naturally want to change. And so how do we do this? How do we keep this on the forefront? Because I've worked at universities where we talk a lot about change, those types of things. But at the end of the day, you look back on the year and very little has changed. And so how do we think about this? And then I want to talk a little bit about the idea of a dual transformation mindset, what that means for the country, for our campuses. So if you think about it, a culture and an organization's natural status quo. It's really what cultures do in a lot of ways. They protect the existing values of an organization. And so for a culture to go through a lot of change is really disruptive and at a very deep value level. And the fact of the matter is we work at in a bureaucracy. Although faculty will resist that, it is true. That is what we work in is a bureaucracy. Bureaucracies exist for stability, for predictability, and for control. Now, those three values are important for well-running organizations, but they oftentimes can be counter to innovative organizations. So the very heart of who we are kind of adds a tension that happens when people really, really try to move forward and create more change. So we talked yesterday, for those of you who were able to come, about really the four aspects that are changing in America, that are creating this dissonance at our universities. And I won't go through these four again. For those of you who came yesterday, will be thankful for that, won't you? But it is true that the difference in the wealth distribution that's happening in America is creating a huge pressure on our cost point. The fact that our costs go up, but the wages our students make aren't going up, creates a crisis point. There's several different points within that. And I think that it's interesting being a faculty member. So my history is being in administration for 25 years. My last gig was the vice president for student life at Baylor. And then I went into the faculty for 15 years, which is, talk about making your head spin, two different cultures within the organization. At Azusa Pacific, taught in the doctoral program in higher education there. And then now I'm working at Warner Pacific in an interesting role kind of toward the end of my career called the Chief Acceleration Officer. Now, when I was at Azusa for 15 years, my research was around innovation in the academy. So I had several grants that put me at about 100 different institutions across the country studying how this innovation was happening and those types of things. And what is fascinating to me and why I think urgency is so critical is that institutions is that there's oftentimes a first push for innovation, and then it just disperses. And we eventually about the same thing that we've done before. And I'll give you the reason for that as we go forward. But I don't really think we understand what's going to hit us in about 5 or 6 years with a declining birth rate, especially for those of us who are tuition dependent, especially for those of us who are primarily middle class, primarily undergraduate traditional campuses. We're just not going to be able to sustain the same types of enrollments, the same types of growth. Now, I always say when I'm talking about this is that there will be some anomalies, right? There will be some traditional private liberal arts that thrive during that time. But the percent of those is going to be much smaller over the next 10 to 15 years. We're going to see many of us being able to keep status quo going and thrive. But when I talk about these on college campuses, this is what I really feel like mostly happens, is that it's like it's almost too overwhelming, isn't it? It's like, well, you know, most of our faculty will think, well, there's nothing I can do about the birth rate. You know, I've had my kids, you know, I can't help that, and there's really nothing, I don't have much control over the way the university runs. And even as administrators, I think when we start thinking about all of the different challenges we have, It becomes this kind of, let me just stick my head in the sand. Let's just try to do what we're doing right now better than we did before. And if we build it, they will come. And the fact of the matter is, especially with the move in technology, is that we just can't afford, given the speed of the advances, to do that. I mean, we just seriously can't afford. We had 5 small liberal arts go out of business last year. We had 7 the year before. You know, everyone projects that we'll have 8 this year. So if you look out over 10 years and we have that same rate, we will lose, you know, 50 or 60 of the liberal arts that we have, and we only have 225, depends on how you count them. That's a huge percentage of our industry that will not exist in 10 years. So we just can't afford, and I'm not trying to be, the sky is falling, but I do want to give us a reality check, because as board members, you're the ones that are going to have to make the very tough decisions of when we just can't cash flow it anymore and when it's going to be time to wrap it up. So you have the fiduciary responsibility. So I feel like, especially for you folks, it's important that you realize these times are very extraordinary. We've had 10 years of talking a lot about this, but we are getting ready for an extraordinary time. And if our campuses don't realize that, if we don't create some urgency, we're going to be like the card catalog, aren't we? It was a useful instrument. I love the card catalog, right? Now, those of you who don't even know that's a card catalog, shame on you, okay? So that will date me. I was at the antique fair not too long ago, and they had a card catalog. And I'm like, ah, that makes me mad that I am now part of the antique fair. But when you think about it, you think about what were you doing 10 or 15 years ago? What technologies were you using? Well, you weren't listening to your music on iPad. You weren't Googling anything. Right? Now, that's hard for me to imagine, right? Because how do we find stuff out? I mean, encyclopedias, that were old when they already were printed? I mean, it's fascinating to think. So we actually had to call restaurants to find out when they were open, and we couldn't look at their menus before we got there. I mean, we couldn't ask ourselves random questions and get our phone out and, oh gosh, you know, I wonder how old the city of Orlando is. I mean, we just have this access to information that we've never had. We weren't texting anyone either, were we? I mean, there was no ability. I said, those were the good old days in teaching when you weren't trying to fight the cell phones in the classes and people texting and those types of things. You weren't reading your email, taking a picture, or doing anything on your smartphone. If you think that just really the iPhone came about in 07, really its distribution was 010, and you think, what was life like before 2010? I mean, it was a different world. I kind of laugh when I was at Baylor. I'm going to date myself, so forgive me for this, but I was high tech because in my dorm room, I had an electric typewriter that had a correction ribbon. Right, right. Everyone's like, oh, wow, you don't have to use that white stuff. You know, yeah, I just press a button, it corrects it. You know, kind of deal. And we still had phones that were actually down the hall. Right? If you would have said, we're going to have a phone that you can drive around in your car and talk on, I would have thought, how are they going to do that with all the wires? I mean, you know, like, that's going to be a big mess. That'll never happen. That was George Jetson kind of stuff to me. You know, we weren't finding directions through our GPS. People always talk about, I think GPSs are dangerous because they, you know, give you information too late. I said, no. reaching over in your glove compartment, pulling out a map, unfolding the map while you're driving, that's dangerous, okay? You know, going down the road at night, trying to figure out what street to turn on by your nap. you know, I was laughing the other day. I was at the AAA getting ready for a trip, and I said, well, you know, do you have a map and a tour guide? And he laughed, and he's like, you know, you're the first person this month that's asked for a map. I'm like, yeah, it's really, you know, our world has changed so fundamentally that it's hard to really even realize. I mean, if you think about this, this was before 2010 in the Vatican. This is after, the exact same place, right? We have this access to information that we've never seen before. And if you even think about it in the internet, think about the waves in the internet. You know, when we first started, this is Southwest Airlines website. Like right now, if you pull that up, you wouldn't stay on it, would you? I mean, you click on through. It's like, oh, that's too complicated. Wow, that was it, you know. And now it's this, you know, beautiful page that's easy to navigate. Remember when Amazon looked like this? And all you could buy were books. I mean, that's in a short period of time, right? That's really in the last decade. Now you can order everything. Your firstborn male child you can get from this. I mean, it's just amazing to me what you can order on Amazon that didn't even exist. And it really changed when search engines came into being. That when Google and Yahoo and AOL and the other search engines, that's what revolutionized the web. Then we got into social media, right, which is added another level of change to our culture. I said, I laughed the other day. I got on Amazon, I was looking for a book, and it only had 3.5 stars. And I was like, yeah, I don't know if I'm going to buy it. I'm like, that's so different and changed, isn't it? That we make all of our recommendations based on 150 random people that read the book, and we think that's it. But that's how social media is changing us. You know, the ability to get online, any opinion that you want to give becomes the reality on it. And we all know that we're in a Twitter culture, which adds a whole different dynamic to our government, those types of things. But what we're really moving toward is really is personalized computing, the data that we're collecting, the Fitbits, and the amount of data that comes off our phone. Our phones, each one of our phones has 7 different sensors that work all the time that track data on us without us even knowing. And it has changed our students in some fundamental ways. After having taught over all of these years, you know, you really begin to realize and it's not just our students, right? But the addiction that there is to the devices. I mean, true, I can't leave my phone. I can't leave that kind of connected world. They say they check their smart devices every 7 minutes. It seems like even more. 44 check social media every hour. They have no tolerance for being without digital resources. And the attention span has really diminished over the last 10 years, really, especially in the last 2 years. Reading has become really a lost art for the generation. We are changing it. We're shifting in now. We call it flip classrooms and things like that, where they go online and they watch videos and those kind of things. And I laughed. I said, you know, the flip classroom, the videos, the things that they see online are really what textbooks used to be, right? You send them away, they read the text, you come back, you have conversation. Now you send them away, get them to watch some videos, and then you come back and have a conversation. And that changes the nature of the classroom conversation. But what's really, really changing is this idea around big data and how much data is collected on us every single day, with every click that we make on Google, with every time we go to Amazon, with every heartbeat that we register on our Fitbit. All that is going into information set. And what has changed is that there's so many more ways that people can capture data. And this greater capacity to store it when the cloud came into being has really, really transformed it. But what's making the difference now is the artificial intelligence that we have. The fact that we can take these huge data sets and make sense of them and make decisions from them really in some deep ways are transforming how we even think about truth and how we even think about reality. But the ability to better predict, and I'll talk about a little bit of how this is changing in higher education, but the ability to use predictive analytics to understand and to know and predict behavior, pretty transformative. 90% of the world's data has actually been generated over the last 2 years, and that was in 2013. So you can imagine that's a much higher percentage. It's probably 98% of the world's data now has been collected over the last 5 years. It's kind of mind-boggling when you begin to think about the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years before, that the data was just not collected in the same type of way. And I laugh, this vice president at Ford made this comment and then very quickly tried to take it back, but it was already out into the Twitter sphere. But he said, at Ford, he said, "We know everyone who breaks the law. We know when you're doing it. We have GPS in your car, so we know what you're doing all the time." Right? And so we forget that. You know, we don't really realize that everywhere we go is oftentimes being tracked. You know that when they begin to do searches on people and things like that, and they begin to, we had a student at one point that was missing, and what they were able to track through her cell phone, through her credit cards, through those kind of things, you realize there really is no sense of privacy and secrecy anymore, unless you just completely go off the grid. So we really are in this new era, and those things are the things that have happened to us in the last, you know, 5 or 10 years. Think of all the things that are happening to us right now. I mean, Google, I mean, Amazon, every time we get on, they learn our preferences. Doesn't that drive you crazy when you get on, you order some things, and the next time you get on, all the things that they recommend to you, you're like, oh yeah, I want that. Oh yeah, how did they know I want that? I did kind of laugh though at Christmas. Last year, I ordered a lot of my gifts for my nephews online, and you know, they're junior high and high school, so they want video games and they want Transformers and they want all those kind of things. So for the next month, I got all these recommendations for Transformers. I'm like, no, wrong person. But Amazon is working right now. Their analytics are working on trying to be able to predict what we need before we need it. Okay, so they can look and see how you might be ordering Tide, and they can predict when you're going to need Tide again, and then they will ship you Tide before your Tide actually even runs out, okay? So a lot of this is going to really even supersede. I mean, they're going to be able to look and predict our buying habits, our patterns, those kind of things. Target has it right now. It was an interesting deal they did. You know, they have an app, and when you come into the store, you the app and you can get all sorts of discounts. Well, the app tracks you, and the app actually knows when you're pregnant before most of your family even knows it, based on what you start buying, right? And they'll start sending you recommendations for things that you would need during a pregnancy and those types of things. So the fact that they have millions of people on their apps giving them this kind of data allows them to do this at a very, very high level. You know, I have a particular type of cancer. It's a good cancer to have. A lymphoma, but you know, they say when it comes back that they can biopsy that tumor and they can tell me with a 98% accuracy how long I have to live within 2 years of it, you know. So then the question is, you know, do you want to know? And I'm like, yeah, I'm a planner. I want to know because I'd like to die with a dollar. I'm going to come even, you know, so if you can tell me the exact day, that would be good. But it's that kind of data that we're going to have access to that's going to continue to transform it. You know, I don't know about you with the banking and the credit cards, but it drives me crazy when I go overseas because my credit cards, unless I notify them, my credit cards won't work because they're tracking me and they know where I live and where I go and what I do. And when I do something outside the normal, I immediately get a notification. And every time I do that, it always creeps me out just a little bit. You know, like my credit card knows where I am. My credit card knows where I live and those types of things. But there is some real benefit and some beauty to how data is beginning to be used in higher education. So Arizona State really early on got into adaptive learning. And they started with a program called Newton. And Newton is a math-based program. So what they found when they collected all their big data, and they got very, very serious, not just on access, but on retention. And what they found is that there was a particular class that if the students passed that class the first time, their chances of graduating were 25% higher than if they didn't pass that class. And it was an introductory college algebra class, okay? And so if a person passed college algebra, their chance of graduating were immediately diminished. Working with Pearson on a thing called Newton, and it is a computer program that students get on, and they take college algebra. But what's so beautiful about it is when you take it and you're working a problem, Newton analyzes what is wrong in your answer, not just your wrong answer, but it will look at how you have done it, and they would say, well, it was really in your arithmetic. You just need to be more careful. Or no, it was really in your logic around this part of the program, or the logic around this part of the program. And then they send the student videos, things like that, just on what it is that they're getting wrong about the problem, right? So oftentimes, we'll grade a math paper and we'll send it back and say, you got this wrong. But the student really has no idea why they got it wrong. They just knew they got it wrong. Well, this program helps them to do that. So you can see their pass rate immediately, very first semester they did it, their pass rate increased 17%. Their withdrawal rate from the class went down half. And early completion, 4 weeks earlier, you see that a huge amount were able to work through it and those types of things, which I also think is important because those students that have had college algebra or are good at college algebra, to sit in a college algebra class for 15 weeks is mind-boggling. But this program allows them to work at their own pace. It tracks them. It gives them real-time data. It feels a little like a computer game in how it gives them data, and it's real-time, fast feedback that they get for it. That kind of adaptive learning, I think, is really game-changing, and I think we're seeing it in a lot of different areas. You know, just talking to Brian from New Hampshire, they were talking about how they're working with Pearson on a natural learning program where papers can be graded, you know, by the computers. Now, you know, for an English major like myself, it like makes the hair on the back of my neck stand up. But for a person who has to grade papers 24/7, I'm like, really? That would be the most transformative thing for a faculty's life if they could really perfect that. We know we already have programs like Grammarly and some things like that that are really helping with the technical. These programs are actually going to be helping with the organization and the analytics part of it, the analyzing it, the understanding how to construct a paper, those kind of things. But you also find firms like Civitas out of Boston, big data firm for higher education. And so they go into a university and they create algorithms that go in and grab all the data they can possibly get on every single student. So they will get everything from what residence halls they live in to what grade they made in English in eighth grade or whatever they have access. They will compile it all in this huge database. So then they go to the university and they say, what's the problem you're working on? So the university that I was working with said, we have low retention rate for Hispanic men's. So they took that data, they took all of our data, they ran it, they came back, and they said, you don't have a problem with Hispanic men. You have a problem with Hispanic men from these five zip codes, right, which happen to be on the border of Texas. And when they take this college algebra class, okay, and they could even tell us which professors were more detrimental to Hispanic men than other professors, right? So instead of just doing this kind of shotgun approach to retention management and trying to do those kind of things, they get you down to this point where you can do interventions that really make a difference. Then you try like five interventions, and they will, in the next 2 years, give you data that says, these three are the ones that are really working. Stop doing these two. Okay? That's kind of game-changing. I get kind of excited about that because it's like we spend a lot of money trying to do things, you know, first-year learning experiences and all sorts of things in the residence halls and those kind of things, and we have no idea, really, at the end of the day, what's working or not. You know, we can say, well, we started these four things, and our retention improved a couple points, right? We have no idea which of the five are working. We have no idea where to invest our money going forward. The problem for us at Small Liberal Arts is that it takes a larger sample size than oftentimes. This is Arizona State. You know, they bring in 8,000 new freshmen. I mean, so their data pools are big. But I talked a little bit yesterday about how we need to start thinking in terms of consortiums. And we think our students are all very different, but actually they're not very different. They come from a lot of the same socioeconomic groups, those kind of things. We could pool our data and get some really great information. So this is an interesting study that Civitas did, because, you know, most people think, well, the kids that are flunking out are the ones prepared. Look what we found when they started looking at this. This is 4-year institutions. These are students that have left. 42% of the kids that are leaving from 4-year institutions are 3.0 GPA and higher. So we're not actually losing. I mean, this is the number on the first-year students that have the lower GPAs. We're actually losing more students at the higher GPAs than we are at the lower GPAs, okay? That's kind of mind-boggling in a lot of ways, because almost all of our retention programs are focused on remediation, right? And we wonder, because we pour all this money into remediation, and we think, why are our numbers not really moving? And I said, I think it's because we're working on the wrong group, right? I mean, even at online programs, 50%, but even at highly selective institutions, who is leaving from the highly selective are the kids with GPAs 3 and above, okay? So this is what I'm saying about, we in higher education have made so many assumptions about what is happening on our campus based on intuition and those kind of things. And now is the era for us to kind of stop that and to really do something more sophisticated and more interesting and actually much more helpful to our students. But we've talked about this statistic in a couple of different venues here, but I think this is the one that higher education really has to stop and ask ourselves, so what? What are we doing about this? You know, recent study found that the probability of computerization for 702 occupations, so it was a broad study, found that 47% of workers in America are in jobs that have high potential for automation. Okay? So that's almost half of the jobs that we have now will at some level be automated in a new and a different way. They also found that 43% of the time for which humans are now paid is spent in activities that could be automated with existing technologies now. So if we had the bandwidth, if we had the capital to do that, we could actually even begin to automate more and more jobs. But the other side of it is that futurists estimate that 85% of the jobs that will exist in 2030 haven't been invented yet. Okay? So this kind of but this focus on job preparation is actually not going to be the way of the future for higher education. And I know I argue a lot about this. And that doesn't mean that we shouldn't give students technical skills. And it doesn't mean that we shouldn't prepare them for first careers. But we really need to be preparing them in a different way, because we are really preparing them for a world we can't imagine. You know, in my faculty at Warner, I'm always talking about if we had two learning objectives, two, and I would say three, really, at our particular institution, I would say these would be the three. Curiosity. I would teach students how to ask better questions, better, deeper questions, because, you know, when you hire people, like when I have a class of curious kids, oh, my gosh, it's transformative. And me as a faculty member, they're asking great questions. Some of mine answer, some of mine can't. But it's just this kind of thing. But even when they go into the workplace, you know, and it's not the questions of, like, you know, how do I get an A or how do I do this job? It is trying to think about their work and their lives in really different ways. And so I think that's what education should be about. We've shifted, right, really 50 years, but I would say definitely with the focus for the test. So they come out of K through 12. And, you know, I taught a freshman seminar not too long ago, and I thought, wow, that's interesting. Because, you know, I gave them a assignment. It's called a wild card assignment. And so they could choose anything they wanted to do in that assignment, because I was really focused on trying to increase their curiosity and their creativity. I mean, the minute I said it, I'm like, you can do all sorts of things, you know, but it has to be focused around this, right? You have to be within the content of the class, you know, but there are all sorts of different kind of ways that you can go about learning this. Now, and the very first thing up is like, well, what do you want us to do? I'm like, well, I want you to go ahead, I want you to explore what you want to do first, and we can have a conversation. I mean, you would have thought the anxiety in the room went up to 98% level of anxiety. Tell me how to get an A. I mean, that's what they're asking. Tell me how to get the grade I want. Give me the instructions. Tell me exactly how you're going to do it. Don't expect me to go out and take initiative or use creativity, because that's not what we do in classes, okay? They do it outside. They do it in other ways. But in the formal classroom, what they really want to know is how to take the test, how to get the A. This is going to kill us economically, all right, if we don't really transform this in some different ways. And this is what we've got to do for students that are coming out. But I would also say this, that, you know, we have got to, the asset that we have in higher education is we have smart people around the table, right? But it's amazing to me the fact that we don't use that intelligence in ways that really moves us out of irrelevance. So irrelevance happens when the speed of change outside an organization is greater than the speed of change inside an organization. And I see in higher ed, you know, the fact of the matter is, you know what, let me skip back. I forgot to tell you the other two learning objectives. Curiosity, in case you're making notes and that's going to drive you crazy. Curiosity. Creativity, not necessarily in the arts, but the ability to take the risk to try something new, I think is essential. And I think a new level of compassion. A way, and I mean in compassion, not a soft compassion, but a compassion in a way that teaches the students how to listen to other people in meaningful ways, and try to understand other perspectives. And so those are my three learning objectives. And creativity, yeah. And not necessarily in the arts, but creativity in terms of the courage it takes to take a risk and try something different. And I think that is where, bless his heart, and you know, and I don't blame this generation. A lot of people blame generations and those kind of things. They are products of our educational systems, right? And so that we teach them how to learn. And in college, we need to teach them how to learn at a higher level. I'm not saying you can begin to do this, you know, in K through 12 and transform it, but I will say, look at the amount of CEOs that have come through the Montessori system. I mean, it's crazy how much higher the level of CEOs, the number of CEOs that have come through Montessori. Montessori focuses on curiosity from its very heart. Anyway, so relevance happens when we don't, you know, really think about it, really focus on what it's going to do. And so I always have said that if we could use the mental power within the organization. But what has happened in higher education, which is so detrimental, is that our faculty who are, you know, think about this resource on your campus, the, you know, the tens and hundreds of great minds. But what's happened to us is that for faculty, and it's a little different as small liberal arts, but I would say it's still there at some level, is that we have become more associated with our discipline than actually with the institution. So we think about ourselves as sociologists first, and then a faculty member at our university, or those types of things. And our discipline creates these really hard and fast lines that make it difficult for us to think outside of those types of things. And I said, we've got to really reshape our faculty to understanding that it's about the institution first, not, and your discipline second, right? That we have to think in terms of how, what's best for the students, what's best for the organization, as we go forward. So that's kind of the idea of urgency, though. And I would say that a board can really make a difference in this regard. So I sat on the Warner Pacific board before I became a staff member there. And one of the things the board did was we passed a resolution about wanting, because we'd really stagnated in terms of growth of programs, we'd stagnated in terms of our willingness to diversify our faculty and our staff and those types of things. And so the board really took it was a very strong statement, and wrote a resolution that went to the entire campus about what we're expecting to see from the campus in the next 5 years. in terms of program growth, in terms of student growth, in terms of innovation in student affairs. I mean, you know, just really trying to, in terms of our expectation for diversifying the faculty, we're an urban institution, and so, and, you know, to have a faculty that's 12% people of color is kind of unexcusable in an urban environment. So we gave them some very debt, and that document really created a sense of urgency. Now, it created a certain amount of consternation, I'll tell you that, and sometimes I feel like, you know, we wasted a lot of time just arguing over the points and those kind of things. The essence of it was to say, from the Board of Regents, we see what's going on. We have the fiduciary responsibility for this university. If we don't get moving in some new ways, we're not going to be here anymore. Now, most people that work in the university just get really busy. We get really busy working on what we're working on. But the board, that's what you bring to us, is you bring to us an insight that's larger than just what's right in front of us. So to be able to do that is really a critical part of what the board needs to do. But let me talk a little bit about what you are seeing across the country in terms of institutions moving in these more innovative ways. So it's a new book that came out last year called Dual Transformations, and he really puts forward these ideas that there are two different types of transformations that happen within organizations. There's a transformation that works within the existing body, within the repositioning the institution. And so these are the kind of initiatives that where we're going back into the university and we're maybe trying to rethink our core liberal arts, or we're trying to rethink those types of things, and we're working within the institution. Transformation B is really creating the new growth engines, okay? So what you see across the country is this move that presidents, boards, other folks have just grown tired of the institution moving so slowly and having such antiquated systems of government that really kill kind of new ideas. And so they've been creating these other entities. So you first saw it a lot in online, right? A lot of institutions created online organizations, online entities, and those online entities did not report anymore through the same academic structure, right? They had their own academic structure, their own way to pass, those types of things, okay? So all across the country, you see institutions really trying, really saying to themselves, we're giving up on transformation A. I mean, we're going to push it a little bit, but it's not going to move as fast as we need it to move. So we're going to go to transformation B and just start creating these entities, all right? And there are a lot of pros and cons to both of those, but I'd like for us to take just a few minutes and maybe just divide the room in half and just have a conversation among yourself about whether you think that is the direction we need to go to really pull off and create more transformation Bs, or whether that divides us in ways that we really can't afford to do. It waters down our brand. It undermines our academic processes. We shouldn't go that way, or maybe we really have to think about creating these kind of growth engines that help us do that. What do you think? Pro and con, what's the good and the bad? So let's just do groups of four, just right around it. Let's have just a brief conversation about that, and then we'll come back together and think together on it as well. Okay, so sorry to cut you off, but we started a little late, so I'm going to keep us moving, but we're going to talk again, so if you're in the middle of a thought, hold that thought. I'm going to show you a video that...
Hey, it's me, Destin. Welcome back to Smarter Every Day. You've heard people say it's just like riding a bike, meaning it's really easy and you can't forget how to do it, right? But I did something. I did something that damaged my mind. It happened on the streets of Amsterdam, and I got really scared, honestly. I can't ride a bike like you can anymore. Before I show you the video of what happened, I need to tell you the backstory. Like many six-year-olds with a MacGyver mullet, I learned how to ride a bike when I was really young. I had learned a life skill, and I was really proud of it. Everything changed, though, when my friend Barney called me 25 years later. Where I work, the welders are geniuses, and they like to play jokes on the engineers. He had a challenge for me. He had built a special bicycle, and he wanted me to try to ride it. He had only changed one thing. When you turn the handlebar to the left, the wheel goes to the right. When you turn it to the right, the wheel goes to the left. I thought this would be easy, so I hopped on the bike, ready to demonstrate how quickly I could conquer this.
And here he is, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Destin Sandlin. First attempt riding the bicycle. Yeah,
I couldn't do it. You can see that I'm laughing, but I'm actually really frustrated. In this moment, I had a really deep revelation. My thinking was in a rut. This bike revealed a very deep truth to me. I had the knowledge of how to operate the bike, but I did not have the understanding. Therefore, knowledge is not understanding. Look, I know what you're probably thinking. Destin's probably just an uncoordinated engineer and can't do it. But that's not the case at all. The algorithm that's associated with riding a bike in your brain is just that complicated. Think about it. Downwards force on the pedals, leaning your whole body, pulling and pushing the handlebars, gyroscopic precession in the wheels, every single force is part of this algorithm. And if you change any one part, it affects the entire control system. I do not make definitive statements that often, but I'm telling you right now, you cannot ride this bicycle. You might think you can, but you can't. I know this because I'm often asked to speak at universities and conferences, and I take the bike with me. It's always the same. People think they're going to try some trick or they're just going to power through it. It doesn't work. Your brain cannot handle this. For instance, this guy. I offered him $200 just to ride this bike 10 feet across the stage. Everybody thought he could do it.
No, you didn't understand. You didn't understand. So, this way. Okay. All right, whenever you're ready.
Go ahead.
No, you have to keep your feet on. All right, let's see if we get it.
But we don't want to, like, you gotta start rolling at least. And go. Oh, God! Okay,
keep your feet on the pedal. Go.
Go right
on. Keep your feet on the pedal.
Tails on.
Yeah, come on.
Once you have a rigid way of thinking in your head, sometimes you cannot change that, even if you want to. So here's what I did. It was a personal challenge. I stayed out here in this driveway and I practiced about 5 minutes every day. My neighbors made fun of me. I had many wrecks, but after 8 months, this happened. One day I couldn't ride the bike and the next day I could. It was like I could feel some kind of pathway in my brain that was now unlocked. It was really weird though. It's like there's this trail in my brain, but if I wasn't paying close enough attention to it, my brain would easily lose that neural path and jump back onto the old road it was more familiar with. Any small distractions at all, like a cell phone ringing in my pocket, would instantly throw my brain back to the old control algorithm and I would wreck. But at least I could ride it. My son is the closest person to me genetically, and he's been riding a normal bike for 3 years. That's over half his life. I wanted to know how long it would take him to learn how to ride a backwards bike, so I told him if he learned how to ride a backwards bike, he could go with me to Australia and meet a real astronaut. Are you going to give up?
No. Go ahead. This is how it starts. Look at this. This is such a big deal. Get up. You got it.
Get up.
Did you see his brain get it? So he, in how many weeks have we been doing this? 2 weeks? In 2 weeks, he did something that took me 8 months to do, which demonstrates that a child has more neuroplasticity, am I even saying that right, than an adult.
It's clear from this experiment that children have a much more plastic brain than adults. That's why the best time to learn a language is when you're a young child. All right, today's bike log. I can ride smooth, I can ride fast. I'm thinking the experiment is over.
Okay, now I'm in Amsterdam, a city that has more bicycles than people. The question is, can I ride a normal bike now? I mean, I've spent all this time unlearning how to ride a bike. If I go back and try to ride a normal one, will my brain mess up? So I've tweeted a Smarter Everyday meetup, if you will, and I'm going to see if somebody brings a bicycle, and I'm going to try to ride a normal bike. It's backwards.
This was one of the most frustrating moments of my life. I had ridden a normal bike since I was 6, but in this moment, I couldn't do it anymore. I had set out to prove that I could free my brain from a cognitive bias, but at this point, I'm pretty sure that all I proved is that I could only redesignate that bias.
So what you're not seeing is just a group of people here looking at me, looking at the strange American that can't ride a bike because they think I'm dumb. But I'm actually two levels deep into this because I've learned and unlearned. Alright.
After 20 minutes of making a fool out of myself, suddenly my brain clicked back into the old algorithm. I can't explain it, but it happened in a very specific moment.
I got it. I'm back. Oh, click. Hold it, click. I got it. Okay, there it is. There's the moment. Okay, I can ride a bike.
Okay. So you begin to see, don't you, how we really are wired in some very deep ways to make it really difficult for us to change our mind. I'm always talking, and there's this idea that, well, you know, faculty or people at the university are resistant to change. And what I keep trying to make the case for is, while that may be true, it might be really deeply embedded in how their brains are wired and how difficult it really is to change your mind and to think about this. Teach a leading change class in the doctoral program at APU. And a lot of the people in there are student services people. And I said to them one day, I said, why don't you do this? Why don't we say we're going to eliminate all the RAs on campus, and then we're going to take that sum of money and you're going to build something back, you know, new, fresh. You know, we've had RAs for 50 years. And you would have thought I would have been dancing on the table with no clothes. I mean, the look on the face was like, I don't even know what you're talking. Just be quiet. Like, I can't even conceptualize. What would we do without RAs? Who's going to keep the rules? You know, blah, 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 blah. And the very first reaction was, this is going back into the way we think about RAs and what they do. And I said, well, yeah, you need to think about that. But if you do this exercise, then it puts you in the space where you can begin to ask yourself, why do we even have these to begin with, right? And then we can build something back up fresh. But I realized that just moving to that place of we're not going to do this anymore created this threat to the cognitive biases that was really disconcerting. And I, you know, the way I think, I'm kind of like, well, that's just a cool exercise. I did not do that again in the next class because it got distracting, the stress that went on it. And so it's very, very difficult for us to challenge long-held assumptions in our work. And I would say, again, that is one of the things that I really encourage board members to think about, because you don't have the same assumptions we have. Now, you probably went to college, so you have some idea of how college worked. But you work in business and industry and law and education and other places and all these ministries and all these other different places that do things differently, that help bring to the table some of those kind of things. But I often find as board members, we kind of apologize for that kind of different type of thinking, because we think to ourselves, well, we don't really know what it's like to be in higher education. And I'm like, thank goodness you don't know, right? Because you're able to really get us out of it. And there's just this deep feeling like, you know, so many of the things that we do are, we consider them to be sacred. And so if you begin to change them, and this is true in a faith base, but it's true other places, people start saying things like, well, we're on a slippery slope, right? But you were saying something that, you know, we have to get really clear on what our values are, what our central values are. Because otherwise, anytime we change something, we begin to say, well, that's getting us on a slippery slope. That's moving us away from our Christian mission. That, you know, if we do online, that moves us away from our Christian mission. We can't do online because we're a face-to-face. That's how faith integration happens. Well, you know, what's interesting, APU did a big study on faith integration and the impact of the classes, and found that online actually had a bigger faith integration impact. Part of that might be stage of life, and part of it is they use coaches. So every student has a coach, and those coaches pray with them and those kind of things. But they do better faith integration online. But at first, when they started talking about online, it was like, you are hurting the essence of a faith-based institution to move into an online. And I think, wow, it's because, you know, I worked at George Fox for a while, a Quaker institution, and they used to always ask this question when arguments would happen. Are you arguing out of preference or conviction, right? And they take a moment of silence to really try to understand, is it just a preference or a conviction? And I think we need to ask more of those kind of questions when we get the pushback that say we can't do this. But it's really hard sometimes to challenge our assumptions because they are so within what we do, right? They're so part of our, just our wharf and woof and those types of things. So we don't even really know what it is. So, but to future proof, we're going to have to really look at our assumptions. We're going to have to really ask ourselves harder and harder and harder questions, because I don't tend to think that we're asking ourselves hard enough questions in higher education. You know, so we always say the liberal arts curriculum is the highest, you know, level of those kind of things. Now, I'm a liberal arts person, so I believe deeply in the liberal arts, and I believe that the future, if we do liberal arts right, we prepare our students in really important ways. But not all the ways we do liberal arts, I think, are helpful. But because we say we value liberal arts, then we value all these other things that go with it, and I think that that's what gets us into trouble. So if you look at it, you hear from faculty oftentimes that liberal arts and the professional programs aren't compatible, right? Professional programs are just about career planning. The liberal arts are the true place where we're helping you to think and to become an actualized person and to grow in your faith, right? And so they really aren't that compatible. So you often find that the liberal arts faculty don't do a lot of socializing and conversation with the professional faculty. So the business school always ends up being the big villain, you know, because they grow so big and they become such a big part, you know, and everyone, you know, think, oh, the business school, they're ruining us, right? They, you know, all they want to talk about is the numbers and those types of things. We also have this idea that incoming students should take the GE primarily their first 2 years, which I have said, well, a couple things with that. One, at 18, you are less likely to get the essence of a liberal arts. Over 4 years, you're transformed and you can kind of understand it. B, we don't do a good enough job of telling them why liberal arts and what we want them to get from it and those kind of things. Most of our students, if you went to your students on your campus and you asked them about liberal arts or the core curriculum, most of them would say, it's something I have to check off. Right? It's something I have to do so that I can get to my major classes. Well, that's a problem, right? When it becomes this perfunctory thing they're checking off, and I don't know how many times I have a student that will say to me, why am I having to take this class? Right? They rarely say that in their majors, but in the GE, they're saying why. But we're like, well, you know, it's good for you. You know, it's like this is why you, you know, drink milk and all those kind of things. It's good for you, right? You know what? That's not going to cut it anymore. That's part of what people think why higher education is bloated, costs too much, those kind of things, because we are not making a good enough case for that. And we also have this idea that general ed is best taught by a single faculty member in a 3-unit class over 15 weeks. And I'm here to say that I think we need to transform our general ed curriculum to being something much more integrated. So we're working on a digital media program, and so each semester what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to take a digital media course and I'm trying to align it with a liberal arts class, right? So the first semester they're taking Introduction to Digital Media, and then they're also taking an ethics course, the ethics of technology. So while they're figuring out how to do digital media, they're also having to ask themselves, what is truth online, right? Because I think it gets very relativistic in an online environment when you can say anything and it becomes the truth. It just depends on how many people click and like what you're saying. You know, the more people that click, the more true that must become. Truth becomes very relative. They need to be thinking about those two things side to side. They don't need an ethics course that's out here that's unrelated to their life. They need a way to think about their lives that makes sense. And that's what I think we need to do. So I said even the Introduction to Criminal Justice, you know, should be paired with maybe the history of justice in America and its relationship to the Christian faith. You know, we should talk about how our Christianity informs our ideas of justice at the same time they're taking the more technical Introduction to Criminal Justice, because that changes the way they think about their life. But we need greater coherence. But liberal arts is one of those things that if it's not broken, you know, then don't experiment with it, don't fix it. But I'm here to try to convince campuses it's broken, right? But we don't see it as broken. So oftentimes I think too, I'm going to run out of time, so I'm going to go pretty fast, but I oftentimes think, too, that we have this sacredness around 15-week-long classes, and they should take 4 to 6 at the same time, right? And I don't know. I have not seen written on any, you know, rocks from burning bushes that 15 weeks is actually sacred, okay? And having them teach, take 4 or 6 classes in a 15-week period distracts them. They usually end up figuring out which of the 3 classes they really have to work on, and the other 2 go away. Even if they have the most interest in those 2 classes, they're most curious, it goes away. So I said, you know, in the 50 to 90 minute time frame that we have really binds us too, because one of the things that I always am frustrated with is, like, I would like, you know, to take my, you know, a criminal justice class and to go have it in a conference room in the jail. Right? I mean, in the penitentiary. I want them to be at the place. If you're studying poverty, I want you to go into inner city Portland, and I want the class to be in a church that struggles with all the inner city issues that do it. I don't want you to sit up here on the hill that is Warner Pacific, but we can't do that. We can't change that because we have a 50 to 90 minute window, so there's no way we can get down there and get back and those kind of things. So why do we allow the schedule, and my registrar friends go crazy when I start talking about this, but we could really do something. We could have 8-week classes where they took 2 classes and 2 faculty team taught those 2 classes so they could work their schedule together. So if your faculty's taking a day-long trip, then that class isn't taught in the other faculty. And we could create some incredible new synergy if we would get over the assumption that classes have to be 15 weeks long, right? Now, I know my registrar friends are like, oh, you don't understand how complicated that is. I know it's complicated. It's a lot more complicated than it sounds, right? But we are smart people, right? We can do things differently. We can use summers differently. We can do that if we have the will and if we have the courage to say, figure it out, because we are going to do something different. All right. I won't go through all these, but this other one is, you know, faculty loads. This is an issue for us financially at institutions. And it's a sacred cow that we never talk about. But a full-time faculty load is 4 classes you teach every semester, okay? But what happens on our campuses, some of our teachers are teaching 4 classes that have 30 students each, so they're teaching 120 students. Some of our teachers are teaching 4 classes that have 10 students, they have 40 students, right? 120, 40. Grading papers, the same assignments, all of those kind of things. You know, how fair is that? And is it a good business model for us? You know, is faculty load, are classes the way that we really generate faculty load? Or is there a different way to think about that that is actually more fair and a better business model for us, you know, as campuses? But that's one of those things where we don't dare, you know, ruffle the faculty's feathers, because that's the way it's always been done. But if it's a business model, if we can work the numbers and show this is costing us an amount that we could save and move and do some really interesting things, we might be able to make that case. Anyway, we don't have time to do this, but hopefully what you'll do at break and those kind of things is begin to think as a board, what are the assumptions that are holding us back, right? What are the things that we say are sacred cows that we can't change that aren't actually sacred cows? Well, they're really not. So then the other one is transformation beat. I'm sorry I'm having to move so fast, but it's not my fault, it's your coffee break. So you know, we look at this area. So this is a transformation V. This is really one of the common examples I can think. We started 20, 25 years ago an adult degree. That was actually a transformation B, because heretofore, we had really been 18 to 24-year-olds, right? And so this idea that we were actually going to start, you know, teaching adults and having nighttime programs and all those kind of things, you can only imagine the consternation on campus about doing this. You know, all the conversation about you're going to hurt our academic credibility, there's no way you can keep the standards as high, you know, all of that pushback. But adult programs began to proliferate, and actually they were the savior for many of our campuses financially. Then we went into online, the same type of thing. You're going to kill us. This is going to hurt us academically. This is going to degrade what we're going to do. But online programs for a place like IWU have been transformative, haven't they? You know, the amount of money they've been able to pour back into the undergrad experience has been pretty significant. This is the question I think everybody's asking is, what's the next wave? Okay, what is the third wave? Because the online environment is so competitive and it's so crowded, and quite quite frankly, the big dogs, you know, they have a fifth of the students in 10 universities, and their national reach and their marketing budgets really difficult for us. You know, we're trying to niche and we're trying to find places, and I think we're using the best we can possibly do. But if you think your online programs are probably going to be your growth strategy out of kind of this a declining birth rate, you're going to have to think more strategically about it, because just putting it up, building it, they will come. Those days are over, okay? They were for the first people, but those days are over, so how are we going to do this? So you see people, universities, in kind of three different directions. I think it's going to blow. Three different directions. You see Western governors has begun this competency-based model, so they build their curriculum and you move as fast as you want. Western governors has this model that you can take as many classes as you want in a six-month period for one flat tuition rate. Interesting model. I know of a few other liberal arts. Mary Harden Baylor in Belton, Texas has tried competency-based. It's not going as well as you would hope. So the jury is still out in a significant way on competency-based. So we'll see where that moves to us. Places, and Brian may have mentioned this, places are moving to kind of these more hybrid face-to-face types of endeavors, and so they're creating more Southern New Hampshire calls pop-up places. So what they're looking at is libraries. If you look at a school like Southeastern in Florida here, what they've done is they view churches across the country. 100 different churches now house their courses. Their courses are primarily online, so basically they can only have 6 people at this church taking the class, but it loads into a class online that's a national class. But the church recruits for you. The church can choose to have some face-to-face courses taught by qualified people within their church. They share some revenue with the churches. So it also helps our struggling churches become more sustainable, but at the same time, it changes your brand. Because a place like Warner Pacific, we don't have a brand in Florida. We don't have a brand in Texas. But you don't have to have the same brand power if you get these partners, okay? I know a couple of other universities that are really beginning to try to figure this out with business and industry. You know, how they locate their course in the small business, in the area that they're doing. So I think pop-up is going to be, and I think micro degrees, I mentioned this briefly, but micro degrees are really, and they're mostly primarily masters. You don't see too many micro bachelor's degree. But you would say, you know, I got a degree 20 years ago, and now data analytics has really changed my industry. So you can come back to the university and take 4 classes in data analytics, right? Just data analytics. You don't have to take all the rest of it. And you can get what's called a micro degree in data analytics. Who's being really successful at this right now is MIT and people with bigger brands. So the word is still out on whether we can compete in the micro degree space. But I think it's an interesting space for us to begin to look at. And then I would say, you know, what it requires for us to do is it really requires for us to think in terms of new spaces, new resources, those types of things. And so for a lot of us, like at Warner Pacific, we don't have a lot of new resources. So the question really begins, you know, not new, but what do we stop doing, which is really the hard question. Now, what's interesting is you can stop doing things when you're in financial trouble, right? Like we stopped a lot of things because we just couldn't afford to do it. What I loved about Point Loma and what they did a few years ago is they went through and they took a very hard, they had a committee, a cross-university committee, that looked at every single program within that institution, academically, student life, administratively. And the president told them, you need to come up with $2 million of cuts, right? Now, they didn't say because we're in financial trouble or because we have to have the $2 million. They said we want $2 million for an innovation fund. And they didn't say what types of innovation or anything like that. They said we want $2 million for an innovation fund. And they created that innovation. And now they're really able to move some interesting things forward because they have the funds, right, to do it. But they didn't connect. We're cutting history so that we can add this innovation. They didn't do that, which creates all sorts of political turmoil. They said, we want more creativity on our campus. We want new and different. We want to reposition ourselves. So we're going to take this hard look and cut. I think that's a thing that we all need to do. But what we've got to do, and this is the question that a lot of universities are facing, is that we need more experimentation and we need more piloting. I mean, we need to try to do some things. I think for a lot of us on short shoestrings. We feel like, you know, our experimentation can't cost us anything. Well, that's not true in experimentation. I mean, when you're having to do it on such a low budget that you can't really experiment, but you can try some things. There's some things that move. But I find that people will accept a pilot study so much easier than they will accept a real change or a movement. And so we've got to empower our people to do these kind of things. We've got to push decision making down. We've got to allow them. What I found in traveling the country is that there are a tremendous amount of great ideas on how to transform higher education that can't bubble up through the system. Right? They can't make it. The people that have these great ideas don't have the power or the influence, and the people in the mid-level, you know, have gotten there oftentimes because they were good rule followers, right? And so they want to follow the rules, and these people that come with all these new ideas are challenging the rules, challenging the assumptions, those kind of things. So we've got to do that, and we've got to find a way to make decisions more quickly. You know, our faculty just went to a one-month degree acceptance approval, right? We went from a year to 4 months. Now we're down to a month. We're not losing anything, right? We're not losing any faculty input, but we're asking them, focus on it faster, right? When we give you, we're still going to have two readings, but you get a week to do the reading instead of a month and a half, 2 months. You can make your policies, you can make your practices better decisions, quicker, faster, those kind of things, more agile. Okay. Anyway, just wanted to let you know that one of the things that I think, I gotta let you go, but one of the things that's really happening across our country is about 25% of the campuses now have chief innovation officers, okay? And I think that that's an interesting conversation to have, because what is so difficult for presidents and busy vice presidents is to keep the innovation agenda before people. And that's what you find the CIOs really are charged with doing, is keeping innovation in front of the university all the time, asking the questions, moving the things forward, getting the resources, finding the ideas at the lower level that don't have the clout, moving them up the organization chart. So it is something that, interesting thing I think for boards to consider, is how do we do this? And I would say in closing that the three things I would say, this is how you can do this, because we always wonder as a board, I did all the time, how can I impact this without getting into the weeds, right? Asking the questions, you guys asking us, don't let us, you know, get away with things. Ask us, challenge us, and encourage the risk taking, because here's the reality. Some of those risks are going to flop. They're not going to work, right? And for the board to have a stomach for that is really important, you know, just to say, hey, it didn't work, but we're going to try something again. And then the most important thing at the end of the day is standing behind your leader. You know, if a leader, if the university knows a leader is vulnerable and the board is not backing them, they will not do any change or very little change, right? They have to know, because let's face it, any president that's pushing change is going to have a certain group of people that are going to want to call the board and tell them this president has lost their mind. Right, but they won't do that if they know the board is supporting this. The board is creating resolutions. The board is backing this president and this leadership team. That makes a huge deal of difference. There's not a campus in the world where the board is not backing the president and there's good change going on. It just doesn't work that way. All right, I'm sorry. I just sped through the end really fast, but thank you so much for your time and your attention. And have a good coffee break and the rest of your conference.